This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The planet is buzzing. Will the economic system collapse? How long will the Texas Dust Bowl go on? In the north, we expect spring floods, but now there are fall floods too? Behind the scenes, in September 2011, the Arctic ice has melted to a new all-time low. I'm Alex Smith, your radio tour guide, as governments and big oil companies plot to keep it all burning. From the White House gates, author Naomi Klein takes you behind the scenes before the arrests, the plot to bring dirty tar sands oil to Europe, covered in the flag of American independence. You are there in Washington as the Aboriginal people take their day to fight Father Greed. Then we'll talk with the leader of the worldwide campaign by Greenpeace to stop this climate catastrophe. Famous activist Sipora Berman stops by. We'll talk about her new book, This Crazy Time. We may squeeze in the latest trying to reclaim a German car maker from the dark side, or the campaign on Facebook against Facebook. Followed by more voices from the tar sands violence against the earth and the sky. This is Radio EcoShock. Outside the White House in Washington, Bill McKibben and the 350.org supporters were organizing a series of protests against the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. That was in early September. The decision was in President Obama's hands. Will the U.S. help front dirty oil to the world? Over 1,200 people said no and were arrested. Wisham is the great green journalist and host of Earthbeat Radio. She sends us these from-the-scene recordings from the White House, starting with this from author and activist Naomi Klein.
I'm a Canadian. That's a big reason why I'm here, because the tar sands are in Canada. And as a Canadian, I feel really passionately that the tar sands violate the values that we as Canadians say that we believe in. They've had an unbelievably corrosive effect on every aspect of life in Canada, you know, on the land, obviously. That's the first and foremost, on the land, on people who depend on the land. Today's the day, the Indigenous Day of Action here at the White House, and there are a lot of Indigenous people from Canada who live downstream from the tar sands, and they have been sounding the alarm now for years because they are dependent on water, wildlife, for a traditional way of life, and so they really are at the front lines of seeing the effects of this massive industrial project. But the tar sands have also had an incredibly corrosive effect on Canadian politics, on the role that Canada plays on the world stage, and you see this at climate meetings. You see this, we saw it in Copenhagen, where, you know, Canada was one of the signatories to the Kyoto Protocol, unlike the United States, and we have violated that agreement just so flagrantly because of the tar sands. Our emissions are up 30% since we signed the Kyoto Protocol. So we've really made a mockery of international law, and that's something that is extraordinary for Canada, because part of our identity as Canadians is to see ourselves as champions of international law. We're not a superpower, so we believe that international law is important. And, you know, we've got it into our heads now with our right-wing government that we can be an energy superpower. And this is really not a future that I think is a healthy one for our country. And I think this is really an ethical issue. It's a moral issue. There's this slogan now being used by the industry itself and by our right-wing government, which is to try to package tar sands oil as ethical oil. And the guy who actually came up with this slogan is a right-wing operative named Ezra Levant. He's sort of our very own Glenn Beck, if you will. And he openly says that he came up with this framing by studying progressive movements for fair trade coffee or, you know, against conflict minerals. And he's really co-opting the language of the left. So I think it's really important that we reclaim it, because the tar sands, I think, are one of the most pressing moral and ethical issues of our time because of the impacts on Indigenous people, but also because of the effects of climate change around the world. When we light this carbon bomb, as Bill McKibben has so memorably put it, the effects reverberate around the world, and the people who feel the effects most intensely are actually not people who live in the North, but people who overwhelmingly live in the global South, who are most vulnerable to the effects of climate change and did the least to produce those effects. So I see this as a moral and an ethical issue.
On the issue of ethical oil, I wonder if you can just describe that ad, because it's pretty remarkable they're claiming.
Well, it's a whole campaign, and the idea is to pit oil from Canada, your friendly neighbor to the north, your friendly democratic neighbor to the north, against oil, what they're now calling conflict oil, you once again co-opting the language of progressive movements, at conflict oil coming from, you know, Saudi Arabia, Iran. And so you have these images of, you know, Gay Pride Day marches, indigenous people, women, you know, having freedom, and they contrast that with, you know, women in Saudi Arabia not having the freedom to drive. They contrast that with repression of gays in Iran, and, you know, it's just every value that we stand for as progressives is being distorted in this campaign, and it's so shameless because, first of all, the companies behind this are operating in all of these places. It's not an either or. The companies that are bankrolling this, you know, are happy to do business with the government of Saudi Arabia. They're happy to do business, you know, with any government that will let them get the oil out. And, of course, the tar sands are not about the U.S. weaning itself off of so-called terrorist oil. They're going to get oil from everywhere. And now what we're learning is that tar sands oil may not even be consumed in the United States. It may be just exported to Europe and Latin America. And this is really interesting because the Canadian government has been on this massive lobbying campaign for the past 2 years, but really ramped up in the past 6 months, lobbying the British government and the European Union to lower their emission standards because there are laws that are being considered in Europe that would effectively ban tar sands oil because it's too dirty. Friends of the Earth Europe came out with a study a few weeks ago that showed that the Canadian government had had 110 meetings with government officials, lobbying meetings, over the past 2 years trying to resist these emission standards. Now, once again, as Canadians, this is an example of how the tar sands are corroding our values. You know, here we are, we've always paid lip service to the need for higher environmental standards around the world and having that in trade agreements, and here we are fighting governments that are actively doing that, and we've done that in the States, we've done it in California, we've done it fighting, you know, the Pentagon standards. So we're going around and we're trying to convince governments, our government is trying to convince governments to lower their standards so that they'll take our dirty oil. But the thing about the European campaign is it never made sense because we don't sell tar sands oil to Europe. And we actually don't have a way to sell it to Europe because we don't have the refining capacity. So now that we're hearing that actually what the Keystone XL pipeline is about is bringing the oil to Texas so that it can be refined and shipped perhaps to Europe, now it all comes together. Now we understand why our government has been fighting so hard to get Europe to take our dirty oil when there wasn't a European market for it before. So a lot of pieces are coming together right now as we start digging into the real purpose of this pipeline. And, you know, the other thing I would just say, Daphne, before I run off, is that this is becoming a familiar pattern of this bait and switch, using the energy security argument to open up new and dangerous fossil fuel tracks. We've seen it with coal, right, where the push to open up the Powder River Basin to more, you know, to more mining leases was sold to people in Wyoming and Montana on the basis of energy security and using a very patriotic argument. You know, aren't you willing to make these sacrifices for the rest of the country? And a lot of people who were against that mining went along with it reluctantly on the basis of this energy security argument. We don't want to be dependent on foreign oil. Now, as soon as Obama approves the leases, we find out that actually they're building export terminals in Washington State, and this coal that was supposedly all about energy security is in fact being exported to China, and that's the real plan. Now we're seeing the same thing with tar sands. This whole thing is being sold on the basis of an energy security argument, getting off dangerous, terrorist, unethical oil. And now it turns out that it's being piped to an export terminal. So we should be very, very wary of that argument.
Thanks for speaking with us today on Earthbeat. Naomi Klein.
Great to talk with you, Daphne.
Thank you.
That was Earthbeat radio reporter Daphne Weisham with Naomi Klein in front of the White House on September 2, 2011. My thanks to Daphne for sharing this with EcoShock listeners. Let's move on to one of the most famous activists in the world.
This is Radio EcoShock.
How can we get
She went from enemy of the state to environmental hero. Sipora Berman filled international news coverage of Canada's largest anti-logging protest. More than 700 common citizens were arrested while the band Midnight Oil played in the infamous Black Hole, a burned-out clear-cut at Clackwood Sound. She is a founder of two groups, Forest Ethics and Power Up Canada, and currently co-director of the Climate and Energy Campaign for Greenpeace International. Now Zipporah Berman has a new book out called This Crazy Time, with co-author Mark Leran Young. Zipporah, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start at the beginning, since this may be the most important tipping point of all socially. What makes a person like yourself become an activist from a former middle-class life?
You know, I started learning and worrying about environmental issues while I was a university student. And I think the first moment for me was a trip to Europe when I was 18. And that year was the summer that people were literally dropping in the streets in Athens, many other places in Europe, because of the smog. And I was in Greece, and I remember getting back to the youth hostel and, you know, pulling my finger down my face and leaving a black line, and I was coughing up black stuff. And, you know, I had been studying art history, and I went to the Acropolis, and it was just crumbling, you know, with the acid. And it was really an awakening moment for me. And I went back and decided to switch my major from art history and fashion arts design to environmental sciences. And in a class in school at the University of Toronto, I saw an image of the temperate rainforest in British Columbia. And I remember thinking, how is it that I'm Canadian? I know about Brazilian rainforests, but I didn't even know that Canada had rainforests. So I got on a backpack and came out to British Columbia, and I spent the summer volunteering for a local group doing scientific research in the rainforest. And the following summer, I came back, and the area that we had been studying had been clear-cut logged, almost completely devastated. And I remember standing in that clear-cut, in that place that I knew so well, you know, where this pool that we used to swim in was just a trickle of water by the side of a logging road, and these thousand-year-old trees had been felled. And I just felt like the pace of scientific research or even legal avenues was just too slow, and I needed to do something. And I heard that there were protests up in Clackwood Sound by the local community, and I went up there to join them.
And when the Friends of Clackwood Sound called for a protest in the woods, they sure didn't expect the mass of people who showed up. Tell us a little bit about trying to organize in those crazy times.
We certainly didn't. You know, I remember at the beginning of the summer of 93, which was the second summer I was in Clackwood Sound, we sat around in our first organizing meeting, and there were six of us, and we said, what if we got, you know, 200 people to come here? That would really hit the news. You know, what if we could get 200 people to come? And that was the time when there was no cell phones and there was still no email. And so we were sending out faxes to tree planting camps and other environmental groups around the province, and faxes to the media, trying to get media interest. And we decided to organize trainings, civil disobedience trainings. And we invited people to come for free and have music and good food, and we would train them in civil disobedience. And people started showing up. We ran a couple trainings with, you know, 50 or so people, and the word started getting out. And when we opened our camp, you know, our protest camp, there were probably about 10 or 15 people showed up to join us. And it just grew. What we were doing captured the imagination of Canadians, and it hit the news. And then, you know, cars and trucks just started rolling in. And it was this, it was, you know, one of those tipping point moments that you see in environmental issues. I think we're experiencing it now on energy issues, but then it was on forest issues. The issue was tipping. People were angry and they wanted change, and the moment was ripe for change. And over that summer, 10,000 people came to join our protest, and there was actually over 1,000 people arrested that summer.
And you were charged with 857 counts of criminal aiding and abetting. What happened to all that?
I was facing 6 years in jail. You know, I was 23 at the time, so it was actually pretty scary. But a group of amazing lawyers, and one in particular, David Martin, took on my case for free. And they argued a charter of rights and freedoms, that I had a right to give speeches and organize, and that when people make a choice to do civil disobedience, they're making their own very personal choice, and that you couldn't aid and abet civil disobedience, which I was charged with aiding and abetting. And we won. So I didn't. I didn't end up going to jail, thank goodness. And instead, I got hired by Greenpeace and started helping to organize Greenpeace International's forest campaigns.
And then after you worked with Greenpeace in Vancouver, why did you found Forest Ethics?
For two reasons, really. I became a mom, and the travel of working with Greenpeace International was just too much for me. I needed to, for the work that I was doing, I was helping organize campaigns in Russia and the Amazon, and there was, I couldn't do that kind of traveling with a small child. But also because the U.S. is the largest market for Canadian forest products. The majority of everything logged in Canada is shipped down to the U.S. You know, 95% of the old-growth forests in the United States are already gone. And Canada still has about 50% of its old growth left. And the majority of it, majority of the logging is going to make junk mail and catalogs and also lumber in the United States. And so I really wanted to focus on U.S. markets in particular, to use what I had learned at Greenpeace to focus specific strategies on the U.S. And I wanted to work for a smaller organization where I didn't have to do as much travel, and honestly, where there wasn't as much internal bureaucracy. Big organizations have big names, and that can be really useful, but it also means that it's harder to get things moving. And once I became a mom, I realized I didn't have 14-hour days to work. You know, I wanted to get home to my baby. So a group of friends and I started an organization called Forest Ethics in San Francisco, and we used what we had learned at Greenpeace and at Rainforest Action Network and many other great groups that helped found Forest Ethics, and created an organization that just specifically works on challenging major corporations in the United States to use their influence to help protect forests. And over the last, I guess, decade, over a decade now, Forest Ethics has helped protect about 20 million acres of forest in Canada and Chile and the United States.
And you became part of a number of groups trying to save the Great Bear Rainforest, and you did manage to get some really big market names like Home Depot and HP to swear off those ancient rainforest products. How did you get these companies to come on board?
Some companies, when we approached them, initially what we would do is we would write letters to all the companies and say, we understand, you know, we had to do research, first of all, chain of custody research, find out who was buying and from which mills. And, you know, in the early days, that really involved following the trucks from the logging areas to the mills, hanging around at the mills, taking tours, trying to, any way we could to find out who the buyers were. You know, now it's far more sophisticated. We have international databases. But we had to find out who was buying it, and then we would send them letters and say, look, I don't know if you know, but here is the impact of the products that you're buying. They're making 1,000-year-old trees and some of the world's most important remaining old-growth forests into your catalogs or newspapers or the lumber on your shelves. And there are more ecologically responsible alternatives. And some companies would, you know, would respond and say, okay, help us. We had no idea. Other companies would simply say, well, you know, it's the cheapest we can get, and it's not our problem. Go talk to the Canadian government. We're not dealing with this. Or their companies, many companies said to us, oh, no, we're not. We've been told that it's sustainable logging or it's second growth logging. And so, you know, companies who are reticent, like Home Depot or Staples, Office Depot, Victoria's Secret later during the Boreal campaign, you know, we launched campaigns. We ran full-page ads in newspapers when we had the money to do that, you know, outing the company for using old-growth rainforest in its products, and we organized protests in front of their stores.
And later, when the deal was completed, and it did save a lot of intact watersheds in northern British Columbia and the central coast there, the forest companies agreed to it, the First Nations people came on board, the government of British Columbia came on board, but you were criticized by some local environmentalists for being too cozy with big corporations. What's your response to that?
You know, I think there was criticism that, you know, we didn't get enough, that all of the old growth forests should be protected. I fully understand where they're coming from. From a purely ecological basis, given that the majority of the world's old growth and frontier forests have already been destroyed, you know, that we have less than 20% left on the planet, I agree with them. From a practical perspective, there is no way we would ever get the companies and the government to say, okay, we won't log anymore. They just won't do it. You can't negotiate yourself out of business. So at that point, when the majority of the valleys were already slated to be logged within the next 5 to 10 years, you know, on the west coast of Canada, at one point we had 359 intact rainforest valleys. When we started that campaign, there were 69 left, and they were all slated to be logged within the next 5 to 10 years. And so by agreeing to end our campaigns, what we got the companies to do is agree to a moratorium on all of those 69 valleys. And so that did mean they were continuing to log outside of those valleys, but we also got agreement that in the logging outside of those valleys, it wouldn't be clear-cutting, they'd do more selective logging, and the First Nations would have increased decision-making in those regions as well, and that there would be a conservation financing program to do economic diversification so the region didn't entirely depend on logging anymore. And so it's a very comprehensive agreement. We protected, millions and millions of acres of forest, all of the intact valleys. You know, would it have been better if there was no logging? Maybe, but I don't think it would be possible. What I talk about in the book and what I think is really important is it may be a nicer moral high ground. You know, the air's cleaner up there by saying no. You know, you want, you know, having absolutes. But the fact is that solutions are messy. They require compromise. And if you're not willing to work on solutions and try and craft a solution, then I don't think that's a campaign. You're not campaigning, you're just complaining. Because in the end, protests and blockades and boycotts, they're not an end in and of themselves. The goal is to try and stop as much of the destruction as possible.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with the famous green campaigner Zipporah Berman. Zipporah, you have one of the most important jobs now in the world, I think. The Greenpeace climate campaign has been active all over the world, showing us where we need to look and do something. Can you describe a couple of recent actions for us?
Yeah, I can. I feel really privileged to be a part of the team at Greenpeace International. It's incredibly exciting work. We've got campaigns running in 40 countries right now, and we are campaigning against fossil fuel development and dirty energy development in many countries like coal, especially coal in India and China and the United States. In the U.S., we just had some great actions where U.S. activists were protesting in front of old coal plants that should just simply be shut down. These are coal plants that are dirty, they're not at all efficient, they're contributing to global warming, and they're contributing to toxins in people's air and water. And so we've had some really brave activists doing actions hanging from coal plants all across the U.S. I think one of the most exciting actions we've done this year is in the far Arctic. We're one of the organizations, I think one of the only organizations in the world really that has the capacity to go to the edges, to go to the frontiers. And really one of the most disgusting examples of environmental irresponsibility right now is the new oil drilling in the Arctic. The Arctic is one of the most fragile environments on Earth, and we're seeing a very scary, rapid ice melt in the Arctic as a result of climate change. Our response as a society to that should be to do everything that we can to slow that down, because the implications of that loss of sea ice for the world's climate and climate stability around the world are huge. It's kind of like the canary in the coal mine, but the response by many companies and governments has been to allow more oil drilling in the areas that have been opened up by the ice melt so that we've found new oil fields under those areas. So Greenpeace took two of its ships this year. We had a team, two teams that went up to the Arctic and followed one of the largest oil rigs in the world as it journeyed from Turkey all the way up to the Arctic. And we had teams that boarded that oil rig in Turkey, occupied it, hanging banners off of it to raise awareness of the fact that it was heading up to the Arctic and it was going to do this dangerous development. And then we followed it all the way up from Turkey all the way to the Arctic, just off Greenland. And then we boarded it and slowed down the oil drilling many times over the last couple of months. And dozens of people were arrested up near Greenland. I think that campaign is critical for a number of reasons, but probably one of the most important reasons is that there is no way to clean up an oil spill in the Arctic. The fact is, we saw what happened in the Gulf of Mexico in an accessible place. If we have that level of spill in the Arctic, the government's own reports show that it wouldn't even be possible to clean up the oil or to stop the spill prior to the ice closing in for the winter. And that's just crazy.
I couldn't agree more. And Zipporah, we will get to your new book, This Crazy Time, but I've got one last climate question for you. And that is, we recently played on Radio EcoShock a speech by Professor John Schellenhuber of the Potsdam Institute. It was at the 4 Degrees or More conference in Melbourne, Australia. And he told the conference that global warming is really unavoidable now. All we can do is to limit the extent of the catastrophe to save civilization as we know it, was what he was saying. Is that the kind of thing you are hearing as well?
yes, we know, I mean, we are experiencing global warming and the impacts all over the world. You know, the dramatic increase in violent storms. I mean, I think no one, probably your U.S. listeners, know that extremely well after the year they've lived through with the wildfires in Texas and the dramatic increase in tornadoes, et cetera. And we do know that we're on a trajectory to hit 2 degrees. And do we have enough time, though, to stop us from reaching 450 parts per million, which would be the point in which at which we can't stop climate change? It skitters out of control. It's like a domino effect. We've lost too much sea ice, and there's not enough reflective surface on the Earth. I think we have time, and I think what I hold on to is the fact that social change is not linear. It doesn't happen in a slow progression. It happens because of a tipping point. We have reached that technological tipping point. We have the capacity today to have a clean, safe energy system and to have renewable power built out to replace our fossil fuel infrastructure even faster than we could build new coal plants and nuclear plants. We know that today. We have the capacity. We do need the political will. I haven't lost hope yet. I'm holding on to the fact that last year, the new investment in renewable energy globally was bigger than the combined investment, new investment in coal, oil, and nuclear. We are living an incredible environmental tipping point, and I think that we still have a chance to make the changes that we need to make.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with activist and now author Zipporah Berman. Zipporah, despite the seriousness of the planet's crisis, there have been some wild and fun times along the way. It's in your new book, This Crazy Time, partly with the help of your co-author, Mark Leiren Jung. Tell us about Mark, and then maybe a story about the zany behind the scenes of green activism.
Mark is a fabulous writer. His last book was one of the funniest books I've ever read. It's called Never Shoot a Stampede Queen, about his experiences being a rookie reporter in the Caribou Chilcotin area of British Columbia. It's kind of like being a hippie reporter in Texas. And he's a very funny man. And I chose to work with Mark in large part because of that. I wanted this book to not be depressing. You know, I've had a lot of fun over the last 20 years, and I really wanted to inspire people to engage in these issues. And there's a lot of great environmental books out there with the information that we need that'll scare your socks off and also depress the hell out of you. I mean, when I finished Mound Biot's book, Heat, it's an incredible book, and I think people should read it. And I just couldn't get off my living room floor and get out of my pajamas for days. I really wanted to write the book that when you close it, you think, that's right. I need to call my member of parliament. I need to join up with Greenpeace or Forest Ethics or Sierra Club and see what they're doing. And to feel inspired to engage in this work. And Mark really helped me do that. He's a very funny man, and we had a really good time writing the book.
We've been talking with Greenpeace super activist Zipporah Berman. And we'll be right back with lots more, including the Facebook campaign against Facebook. Stay tuned.